I heard a lot about Hugh Martin before I actually met him. Naturally, I was a little jealous because he's Wit's best friend. Then I found out he's also a poet, an essayist, with an impressive list of publications for someone so young. His book, The Stick Soldiers, was published in 2013 with much success. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Grantland, The Rumpus, among many others. I was prepared to hate Hugh. However, when we met, I was impressed by his modesty, charm, and sense of humor. But don't be fooled. I once made the lethal decision to send Hugh one of my poems. It was returned with one line left standing. Hugh can always be counted on for the truth, and that is invaluable. We are especially lucky to have such a brilliant writer, and most importantly, our friend, here with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming Hugh Martin.
Thank you, Kelsey. So, your phone. Oh, wait, this is the. Sorry. Okay. She's recording it on her phone right now. Okay. Yeah, okay. I was just going to say, too, I met Whitney when I was about 21, 22, and he had dropped out of college to go to work in Hollywood. So, if you want to know how it turned out. But what I was excited, I wanted to be a filmmaker too, and then I thought he was like my ticket, you know, to the big show at Muskingum College, and I ended up just hanging out at his house with his dad's goats and his, that was it, you know, that was it. So, follow your dreams, but yeah. So let me see here. I'm gonna read a short essay. It's 8 or 9 pages, and. It's sort of about just veteran stereotypes and veteran identity, and it comes from the quote that is the title. It comes from a writer philosopher named Dixon Wechter, and it appears in the fourth section. You'll see, but it's called Three Great Lyric Passages, and it's set in a bar. And this was something that's maybe 8 or 9 years ago. It happened a while ago, but that's where it's kind of set up the narrative. I guess begins there, and then it moves to other places. So I'll just read that, then I'll read a few poems, and then if there's any questions or anything, we can talk about that. So just three great lyric passages. One, it's number. After a night out drinking with friends, I wandered off alone and went drinking by myself. I ended up at a place that had a long high bar with plush cushioned stools. In a large room with purple lighting where a DJ played and people danced. I sat and drank 2 PBRs just because I wasn't ready to go back home. After these 2 drinks, somehow, I ended up face to face with a guy my age, early 20s. We stood near the bar, yelling above the music space, arms tight at our sides, our noses inches apart like we were waiting to peck at each other. I can't remember how it occurred or what we were yelling about, but both of us were angry and pretended, at least I did, that we wanted to fight. Not that I was counting, but I probably had a dozen beers at that point with 3 or 4 shots. I could hardly stand. I remember he pushed into my chest with his forearm. I know I grabbed his wrist and tried twisting his arm down. Heads at the bar turned, but then I said something, a phrase I'd used maybe a half dozen times over those years in previous situations. I've been to Iraq 3 fucking times. The pre-flight conversation did not have any time for past tense indicators like have or anything. And I surrounded the information with rhetoric like look now, motherfucker, or listen up, bro. But the argument was clear. I've been to Iraq 3 times. But that was a lie. I've only been once. 2. Before Trinity High School dismissed me sophomore year for poor academic performance, I learned about the importance of the triad. The Trinity, of course, referring to the Christian idea of God being composed of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. All are distinct, but make up the one God. The number 3 has its own legendary status as, according to Pythagoras, the perfect number, representative of beginning, middle, and end. Saying I'd gone 1 time just didn't have a ring to it. Neither did 2 times. 3 referenced that long history of mythic, religious, and philosophical meaning, faith, hope, charity, Oedipus and the riddle of the 3 stages of life. In my pre or post blackout state, I wasn't aware of the significance of three when I'd said it, but there had to be a reason why. I deployed to Iraq once in 2003 and spent 11 months there in 2004. Why not just say I've been to Iraq one fucking time? Wasn't that enough? Three. It's no surprise in this country veteran status can help you receive perks, benefits, and generally an all-purpose excuse from other shortcomings you may or may not have developed or intensified during your time in the service. A Vietnam veteran once said to me, some people are already fucked up before they went to Vietnam. To exhibit the benefits of calling oneself a combat veteran or something similar, laws recently have gone into effect to prevent individuals from stealing valor. In 2005, George W. Bush passed the Stolen Valor Act, which, in short, called it a crime for anyone to lie about military service. This was soon considered a violation of First Amendment rights, free speech, and an updated version was signed into law by Obama in 2013. In this version, it's a crime to pose as a veteran in order to obtain any kind of profit, property, or tangible benefit. No American hero, Obama said, of these situations should ever have their valor stolen. But couldn't I exaggerate my valor? Couldn't I take my valor and say I had a little bit more of it? Is there only so much valor one man can have? Four. Maybe I meant three times metaphorically. My arrival in 04, my two-week leave in September 04, then how it's remained in my life as a constant echo. Something. According to the writer and social historian, whatever that means, Dixon Wechter, for the soldier, the warriors are the one great lyric passage in their lives. So why not have three great lyric passages? Terse, right? Five. After driving home from another night out, I left the freeway at 2 a.m. and had about a mile until I could park at my girlfriend's. I drank a lot 3 hours earlier, but after chicken wings and ranch dressing, I'd sobered up and passed on the opportunity to sleep at a friend's. I'm not sure if this night of drunkenness was to satisfy the struggling, heavy-drinking veteran stereotype, or if it was a genuine attempt to be drunk. Whether it's films, books, television, I wonder how many veterans return home with ideas about how they're supposed to act. How much was I influenced by those ideas and perceptions about the returning veteran and his or her place in the States? Was there a pressure to conform? Should I be more angry? Should I be less angry? Should I be like Tobey Maguire in the film Brothers and destroy my wife's kitchen cabinets with a crowbar? Red lights flashed in my rear view. I pulled over. This is a truism after Iraq. There's a first time for everything. Watching TV, McDonald's, Denny's, a grocery store, sitting in a civilian vehicle, a kiss, walking alone without holding anything, sleeping whenever you want, filling up a gas tank, putting on jeans, sitting on a couch, walking down the driveway to get the mail. This was my first time being pulled over. As the officer approached, I knew I was going to mention Iraq. I was scared. The alcohol was in my system, my breath. My hair was still cut, high and tight. Dog tags hung around my neck. I pulled open the jacket and lifted the silver chain so it would be more visible, resting on my collarbone of the light. I held the Ohio ID, the military ID. I'd shaved the previous morning. He pointed the flashlight in the window. How are you doing tonight? Good, sir. Just heading down the road here to my girlfriend's. You didn't make a full stop back there. Oh, I'm sorry about that, sir. Can I see your ID? He looked it over. You got anything on your record? No, sir. I've been in Iraq. When I say that word, it bursts into the night like an expletive. That's when he actually looked at me, directly at me, into my eyes, his flashlight pointing to my legs, my hands on the steering wheel. I knew he noticed the dog tags, the haircut, the clean-shaven face. You got your ID? I handed him the military ID, and he took it with the driver's license back to the cruiser. Right then, I'm nervous since I've just told a lie. I had been back from Iraq for almost 2 years. I justified it. Like it's so often said, soldiers are always coming home. Was there a way for him to know? What if he returned and asked, when did you get home? Oh, sir, I'd pause and look out into the night, hardly able to continue. Every day feels like I just got back. Well, son, thanks for your service. He'd hand me the IDs. We appreciate all you've done. Get on home. As I considered all this, he walked back after a few minutes and pushed the IDs out the window. You're just going down the road. Yes, sir, to my girlfriend's close. Okay, be careful. Have a good night. When he walked away, I was glad I didn't have a ticket. I was happy he didn't test my breath. I was happy I'd embellished. I drove off and wondered how long it'd be until I no longer felt comfortable saying I just came home. Six, like the character Krebs and Hemingway's In Our Time, I soon understood some facts about lying. Certain moments and contexts required me to exaggerate or overemphasize or sometimes understate that one and only deployment. After returning to Oklahoma from the Rhine in World War I, Krebs learns that he can't always tell the truth. Later, he felt the need to talk, but no one wanted to hear about it. Krebs found that to be listened at all, he had to lie. Krebs soon understands that the town had heard too many atrocity stories to be thrilled by actualities. Today, the atrocity stories are still abundant, but maybe because I know some of those soldiers who deployed 2, 3, 4 times, I have to amplify my experience out of fear that once is not enough, out of fear that someone will respond as they have before, that their son's friend's neighbor is a Marine who went 4 times, or their stepfather's uncle's son went to Afghanistan and he's going back. When I mention Iraq, sometimes civilians will go to great lengths to mention some connection, no matter how small they have, to the war. Being a veteran, I could adjust the volume of my status to suit the situation. I sincerely felt confusion, anger, fear of going back, but at the same time, I was relieved to be home. People treated me like I was damaged or broken. It made me ask, am I damaged or broken? Can I not see it since I'm so far inside myself? You drink for a lot of reasons. Your friends do it. You had to make it for lost time, to not care if you talk too much about it, to not care if you didn't talk about it, to think of something to say not involving Iraq. It took years to distinguish between genuine feelings about the war, about veteran life, from those that were pressed upon me. 7. As an intern for a news station in Washington, D.C., I tagged along for a short story about World War II veterans visiting their memorial on the Mall. We stood by the large fountain at the Memorial Center on a cold day. The producer was having the talent, Clear Shipman, interview veterans. Where'd you serve? What branch? What memories do you have? We saw a man wearing a black World War II veteran cap. Perfect. Before recording, Claire asked pre-interview questions. Where'd you serve? Well, actually, he leaned in beside her. Before looking around the memorial to see if one of the many other veterans were close enough to hear, he whispered, I actually didn't go overseas, my shoulder. And he grabbed his shoulder as if to present it as an exhibit. Here, look at this. He talked about how he'd heard it, something about construction, a job, and why they wouldn't send him. At this point, Claire could no longer interview him. We only wanted former soldiers who'd been overseas, but the man kept going, kept talking. He made it clear he'd served in the States during wartime, but regretted every day that he couldn't go, that he didn't. The shame he carried was so overwhelming that once he began discussing the shoulder and why it wasn't his fault for not going, we couldn't stop him. Claire gave him a hug. We moved on to find another veteran, one who had gone overseas. The man continued talking even as we folded up the tripod. This was my first time seeing guilt for not going. It reminded me of the line in Tim O'Brien's Things They Carried, men killed and died because they were embarrassed not to. I first encountered the line in a short story class. It stopped me. I disagreed with it. What about all those things, the honor, brotherhood, the selflessness, the sacrifice? Those make up the Army values. But even if you think you're doing it for brotherhood, glory, sacrifice, you're still saying you'd be embarrassed, ashamed, to not fire back, to not fire first, not run across the street in gunfire, not jump on the grenade, not climb over the trench into machine gun fire. Some men would rather die than live their lives knowing that they said no, that they didn't or they couldn't go. To many of those who didn't go, it remains an experience held atop a pedestal with the dust of mystique. It's what Christopher Isherwood discussed in his memoir, Lions and Shadows. War, in the purely neurotic sense, meant the test of your courage, your maturity, are you really a man? Whether passing means going and coming back or going and coming back in a casket, I'm not sure. According to Isherwood and many others, failing the test certainly means backing out. For the World War II veteran, he'd signed up for the test but couldn't take it. At the time, as he kept on talking, I wanted us to point the camera and just let him talk, let him speak. No need to tell him we couldn't use his interview, just let him speak. It was clear the guilt had been following him his entire life. We didn't need to forgive him, but at the memorial, it seemed he wanted someone just to listen to him, explain, to tell him, yes, we understand, it wasn't your fault, we forgive you, don't be embarrassed. 8. I'll never know how much of my early adolescent failures are conflated with my struggles after Iraq. There's a tendency for veterans to sometimes think who they were before the deployment, before they joined, is somehow gone from existence when they return. In some cases, it's true. But many of the insecurities and issues one has before Iraq carried over into the lives after. I cannot say how much my joining was prompted prior to 9/11 because of my own failures. You can be terrified, dumb, naive, but joining will make you brave. Joining is the easiest part. 9. In that bar, the man backed off. I don't remember what he said afterwards or if he said anything, but the possibility of a fight ended right as I said, Iraq. I would have ended up with a black eye or knocked out or something else similarly deserved. I wonder how often I appropriate the word Iraq and the war in general, but then again to appropriate, to make one's own, isn't the war mine, my life, mine for the taking? I tell myself, you burned shit. You sat through IEDs. You went out into the July Iraq summer with no sleep in layers of gear while waiting for people to shoot at you. You spent the 19th and 20th year of your life training for war, being in war. You stood in all those lines for shots and vaccinations and planes. You did hundreds of police calls where you stood in a formation to pick up garbage and cigarette butts in a field and parking lots in vast spaces of Mesopotamia covered with gravel poured from dump trucks driven by contractors. You went all the nights, not showering, wiping your ass with baby wipes, but you signed up. Why not take what you can? The free coffee from Starbucks, the 5% off rental cars, the complimentary Applebee's meal, the discounted hotel room. Tell the cop you were in Iraq. Tell anyone talking shit you were in Iraq. When it's necessary, say you went 3 times, 4 times, whatever. Use the great lyric passage whenever you can. Who knows when they'll be bored by actualities? Who knows how long it'll be until you say Iraq and they say what? Where? Before they punch you in the face. So that's that there. It's kind of a weird little essay. Okay. Yeah, see, it's funny. I was thinking about that for, you know, I have a few essays that I'm working on. They always take forever. But now I read it now. It was taken a few months ago and published. And I read it now, and there's just a lot of sections I would write differently. So I can't imagine how I'll feel in, like, 6 months or a year. So, but anyway, one way to revise is just to give a reading because you just, like, I skipped a lot of sentences too, but anyway, so trust me, you're better off not hearing them. So, okay. So I'll read some of these poems here. You know, these newer ones that I have here, they deal with the same subject matter, of course, but they're, I think the persona is trying very much to move away from my own experience. And so, I guess, you know, my background was, I went over there, I was 19, 20, and we were all tankers, and they retrained us as kind of infantry. We were on Humvees. But I was, out of our 60 in the platoon, or in the company, the 60 guys there, I was one of the three or four younger, I was one of the three guys under 21. That's how we were identified, because we couldn't drink. So we were always had to, like, you know, try, well, you didn't drink over there, but before the deployment, we were like, you know, drinking beers in bathrooms and things like that. That's, you know, you go to strip clubs and we drink outside by the garbage dumpster. So that's what it was like before I deployed. So it's really, it's a wonderful thing. So it was glorious, you know, I come home, thank you for what you're doing. It's like I'm chugging beers under a trailer behind a strip club. So, yeah. Anyway, so so I was one of the younger ones, so I drove our Humvee because that's like the lowest, you know, that's what you do if you're the lowest ranking. Because technically, you know, the guys in the Humvee, they're supposed to be pulling security. They pull their guns out, the gunner. But, I mean, I swear to God, half the time they just sleep, you know. They just sleep. And my platoon sergeant, he never slept, like, the whole time. But it was just a shitty job because you always had to be awake. So a lot of my poems come from that speaker, you know, like Hugh Martin back from Iraq. So now I'm writing more, I guess, in this vein where the speakers are trying to be just a little bit different and have more personality. And so maybe that's working, maybe not. This is a poem about frisking. And you see this a lot, you know, now. Just, I mean, cops do it all the time, right? You just kind of search people up real quick. But we did this a lot over there. And it's obviously much different because, you know, I mean, okay, so I'm a 20-year-old kid from Ohio. And I go to, you know, two 56-year-old Iraqi men and I tell them to stand up so I can basically feel them up. There's a lot of weird stuff going on there, you know, and they would make the lower enlisted guys do this a lot, of course, right? Because, you know, it's a shitty job. So this is about one of those experiences when, you know, these two guys, it comes from, I always say poems are kind of, you know, you have to understand, they're playing with an experience and you're shaping and molding an experience. It's not nonfiction, but a lot of these do come from just like a lived experience, and then I try to do what's best for the poem. But this is about a time we walked up to two, you know, 6-year-old guys in Iraq. And if you imagine you're 60 in Iraq, you've lived in that country for 6 years, like 60 years, it's like you can't imagine what a person like that has been through. So they see me come up with this other guy, you know, to get them to stand up and search them. And just the way he looked at us, like it's one of those things you can't articulate. You cannot put it in the language, but it was terrifying. You know, just the way he looked at us. Just like we were, I don't know, just like less than human or something, and little boys, which we were, you know, little boys. So it's just called Frisking Two Men in Asadiyah. That's one of the towns we were in charge of, Asadiyah, 80 miles northeast of Baghdad. Kenton says to search these men since they've watched us by the road all morning. I go down to the dirt on one knee, begin at the ankle where the thin cloth of the man's gray, beige dishdasha grazes the skin. My palms and fingers climb, like up a rope, and push at the outline of leg. Marson watches to the side with his rifle, mine slung over his back. This man, maybe 60, doesn't take his hazel eyes off my face. As I slowly reach the space where my right knuckles brush the scrotum's loose weight, he doesn't blink. I frisk the other leg and stand, my forehead level to the chin, peppered with stubble. I smell the warm breath of smoke. I pat his torso up to the pits of outstretched arms. I feel the cigarette pack in his breast pocket. Then I lean forward, slide hands down the smooth of his back. The magazine pouches on my chest press his stomach. He sees through the smoke-gray ballistic glasses I wear, all of us wear, for explosions, for sunlight. And as I squeeze both arms through his sleeves, I think he'll be the one, after hundreds, to spit gently on my face. I tilt my head in the periphery, Marson, just to see he's there. When I step back, the man studies my face as if to put it all to memory. All I want is to grab my rifle, but the other man steps forward, lifts his arms, and waits for my hands to begin. I'll read this other one. I'll read a poem about the town we were in was called Jalula, and it was, you know, when we were there, there's about 30,000 people, mixed Kurdish and Sunni, and we were in this town, you know, almost every day. And so I have a little poem that kind of opens up the book. I would call it like an anti-pastoral poem maybe, but it's just called Spring in Jalula, and you know, this is just based on a lot of the images we saw every day. But I wrote this poem, I wrote this a long time ago. I just was making catalogs of images. So, Spring in Jalula. The air is exhaust smoke and desert heat, the black sewage streams that don't dry. Cows graze beside the river of shit. Their noses sift through soggy trash. Last year, the liquor store was hit with two RPGs. Today, the store is a pile of brick. When buying a car, it's cheaper to buy the one with bullet holes. Muhammad, the 10-year-old who doesn't go to school, sells everything. When you hand him 300 dinars, he runs through the streets, returns with Pepsi, chicken. Zamzam, he asks. DVD, freaky. 4. After weddings, the people fill the sky with red tracers fired from Kalashnikovs. Tracers pass through darkness, but somewhere they fall back to Iraq. There's always a new bomb. Each week someone finds one hidden beneath bricks, buried beside curbs. At dusk, people burn trash by the river. The smoke's white and blue. Daoud, the town bum, walks the streets barefoot. The cuts on his toes never heal. When he sleeps on the same piece of cardboard beside the vendor stand, all night he yells in broken English, but no one knows what he's saying. Okay, I have a little prose poem in here. That's while we were over there, we used a lot of the disposable cameras because we didn't have the digital ones. Well, some guys had digital ones, so we used these Kodak disposable cameras. And this is about an experience with that. And it's kind of a true story. So it's just called "Pictures of the War." When I sent home a disposable camera so my parents can develop the film and see pictures of the war, I don't know that Ellis stole it and photographed his penis. Giggling with a wad of dip in his lip, he tells me, after I send it, how, sitting on his bunk, he pulled up his boxers and pointed into the darkness and clicked. I imagine my mother taking the glossy photos from the envelope as she walks out of the store. I'd already taken up half the roll on the drive from Kuwait. Ellis's picture was somewhere in the middle. Most likely she'd thumb through the section and see row of mud homes, children shouting for candy, rusting T-72 tank, her penis, sorry. I didn't want to say it. I feel uncomfortable saying penis. So no. No, I love saying that word. Okay. I just taught before I drove here. I'm a little winded. Okay. Back to this thing. Okay, the question was whether or not she'd recognize it. She might think her son is with a bunch of men in the desert, the penis part of some joke, and move to the next photo. Or maybe she'd slowly flip through the pictures and study each one, thinking, my son's at war. This is what he sees. And upon gazing at the close-up of the penis, think only how it reminds her of one, and scold herself for those thoughts. She might stand there and squint, moving closer, and after a few seconds become fearful, presuming it was the blurry result of a camel in the desert darkness. She never said anything about that photo, so. But it was, I saw it, it was just, I don't know what was going on. My parents, I'd send photos home, the Kodaks, you know, just get rid of them, then they'd send me back the photos. So I'd be in Iraq getting pictures of Iraq. I was like, what the, it's like, what is, they're like, I don't know, maybe you want to see what you're doing every day? I don't know, like, I never really asked about that. That's strange. Okay. This is a poem, more recent. There's, you know, people, you know, there's this idea where you're taking, it's not an idea, it's a big risk, you know, someone else is suffering, and you're trying to put it into, you know, a poem, or put it on the page, or put it into, I don't like to use it, like art, you know, whatever. So there was one night where we were in town, and a guy was just, basically, I mean, he was getting the shit beat out of him. And I don't know what he did or what he said. He might have been out after curfew. He might have just been drunk. He might have just been, I don't know, Shia, and they were Kurdish. I don't know. So the Iraqi police were just beating the shit out of him. And so I wrote a poem about it, and it was just very direct, like, here's what happened, blah, 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 you know, many years ago. And then I wrote another one, like a short essay about it. But I was trying to figure out, you know, I was trying to take that memory, that experience, that moment, and shape it and mold it with the right, I don't know, with the right form, with the right voice, the right speaker. And so this is where it's at right now, you know. And that was just, you know, one little night. It was like an hour something happened. And there's all kinds of other stuff that I'm kind of obsessed with. But for some reason, I don't know, there was like this voyeurism going on where we were watching him being beaten, and then our lieutenant jumped in to stop it, as he should have, I guess. But then writing about it, you know, it's like, well, what am I trying to do? Am I trying to put his suffering on the page and to somehow, I don't know, bring attention to it, or to do justice to it? You know, how would he feel about this? And I'm not really sure. I don't know. And there's the one line I always throw around is the, if you know, the Duncan Levertov argument with, they were writing during the Vietnam War, and they were best friends writing letters. I mean, a big book of letters, you can buy it. And their friendship ended because Duncan basically said that, you know, and I'm simplifying it here, but he disagreed with her politics that she put into her poems, and how she was involved in protests. And he was very much, he said, you know, the role of the poet is not to oppose evil, but to imagine evil. So he says, you know, Shakespeare, you know, someone like Iago, like, he creates evil, and we can see evil in a new light, you know. But if Shakespeare had, like, opposed him or told us how to feel about him, that would kind of corrupt our own emotions and feelings, and it would, like, somehow, you know, I don't know, it would just corrupt how we thought about it. You know, he wants the reader to be involved, so he doesn't want you to pushed in a certain direction. However, what Levertov was doing was really beautiful with her work, and I still don't know. There's a lot of argument about what he meant, but I'm trying, I guess, to understand that, just that idea, you know, opposing evil versus imagining it, you know. So, but anyway, so this poem, this is where it's at now, and it uses the very famous poem you all know, the Plum poem from William Carlos Williams, where it's like a little note on the fridge. You know, he just basically it says, "I'm sorry, I ate these plums. You know, forgive me. They were great plums." I mean, that's not really the poem I'm not doing, but it's something like that. So, and so this is a poem about the first poem I wrote. So, and it's just called "Describing a Man's Face After Rifle Butts on a Street." "Too easy," they said, "to say the man's bruised face was like a plum's cold skin. Two out of left field. Cold blue plum I'd written. Plus, those plums made them think of Dr. Williams's plums. Did we want that?" So here's what happened. We'd heard shouts from somewhere near the police station. Shouts. I mean screams. I mean a sound that tore through Jalula's curfew. Just a man yelling for his dear fucking life. We saw six, maybe seven, police in a small circle. On the ground, the man in the middle of the circle. The men kicked whatever limb or hip or ear just happened to be there as he writhed and shook. Very carefully, an officer turned his rifle, holding the muzzle with both hands. Then he swung it like you'd swing, how to say, a tennis racket? Perhaps a baseball bat. Can I use a common domestic tool for sport? Won't that bring the hitting more home? I have to remember, audience. But the man kept moving, ducking. So the officer just stopped the useless swinging and instead smashed the wooden butt straight to the man's bloodied face. Through flashes in that space where the officer pulled back the rifle so he could load up to do it again, I saw the face. Blood and blue skin shining in the dark, like skin on a plum. At the time, I did not think plum. Our LT yelled and pushed through the circle, and the officer, tired, put in one, two, three more. The man breathed heavily. As he lay there in his own piss, I saw his eyes shut, sealed with swollen skin. This isn't to say this incident, just one evening event, is to showcase some good-intentioned soldiers saving men from beatings. We, mostly, weren't. This is just to say, I think that man's face, the skinned, seemed as dark blue as a plum's. But what's it matter? Dr. Williams, maybe, could have done something more practical. Maybe he could have fixed the face. We do know, after eating those plums, the plums that weren't his, Dr. Williams is sorry. He really is. He even asks for forgiveness. He does say, "Please forgive me," in that poem, if you read that poem. So, I'll read, what's that? Read a couple more. I don't know what. You can't ask the audience, should I read more? Because they're always going to be like, yes, yes, yes. So no one's going to say no. So, yeah. 15 with 20. So it's been about 40 minutes. Okay. So if I'm at a reading 20 minutes, I tune out. I check out. So I just check out. So I'm serious. I'm not even kidding. So, okay. All right. It's very hard to listen, right? I was at AWP. I went to three readings. I was done. So I just done. You can't, I don't know, you can't absorb poetry like, I don't know. It's not like food or something. Okay. A little bit at a time. I'll just read two more short ones. And then this one is it's more of that distant speaker where on the top of our truck we had a 50 cal gun. And so I'm writing poems in a little series about the from the perspective of the 50 cal gunner, which was not my job, you know, and it took me a while after Iraq to basically write about stuff that I wasn't doing, because there is this unwritten rule in the military, like you don't embellish your experience, you don't say you were in Fallujah if you weren't in Fallujah, you know, things like that. And I always brought that to the page. I'd say maybe fortunately, but also unfortunately. You know, so now I'm writing more. I'm trying to push out into experiences that weren't necessarily mine. So this is called 50 Cal Gunner. And I just, I have some 50 Cent poems, or 50 Cent lyrics in here. So I'm like, I was happy about that, you know? So I'll just read this one, and a couple more. So, and it's part of the series, so I'll read that one, and maybe one short one. So, and if you know the song In Da Club, yeah. Let's see the song here. It was came out in 2004, and we, at the time, you know, we had MP3 players. They could hold, like, you know, 30 or 64 megabytes. So that was like, I listened to REM for like 6 months. So one CD, REM. The one with the man on the moon. Okay. So 50 Cal Gunner. One, all day I aim at date palms. The hood's covered with dried stains, dip, coffee I've spit. Dalton always yelling from the hole. Not on my truck, Dick. Dust here, dust there. How many duds don't blow? I don't know. Inside the Kevlar, another song stuck, even over the constant mosque music. I'm into having sex, not into making love, but I'm not having, not making. Dalton says it's my anthem. My wish, make devices exploded, improvised. I keep both thumbs on the butterfly. This camouflage keeps my vitals very much part of the sand I stared on all day. LT says the 50 should make people unhappy. At home, they don't know all I do. Aim at date palms. Three, been hit with a few shells, but I don't walk with a limp. But mostly we drive, and I aim at date palms. I saw what it said in all that fine print below, mission accomplished. Accomplished, of course, but please send 4,000 plus body bags. Bring them back, please. No empties. This is another short one from that same series. There was a 10-year-old kid in our town. His name was Muhammad, and he never went to school, and he sold us everything. So we called him Mini Muhammad. So this is part of his series. So Mini Muhammad. Call me a homesick, sunburnt, superstitious speck four, but Mini Muhammad moves with magic. Our little man weaves waist high, smooth as minaret music through white-gray distasha waves. Always a smile, those two top teeth chipped from a fall. His pink flip-flops smacking the road as crowds part for our wish deliverer, our city salesman, the spokesman for the plastic bag, Pepsi Special. He runs so fast, the cans come cold. Okay. This section, just it's washing the tank, and this is the same speaker, 50 Cal, washing the tank. Fork pulls forward, I hold the hose. Mud spits from the link slits. The steel skirts hang open like wings. In the mist I hear, Virgin Mary that shit. It's Dayton, our favorite lieutenant. Pristine, clean, he yells, then smacks my ass. It was his idiot crew that got the thing stuck, trying to cross the causeway to Sadia. Skirt to gravel, a brown mud earth mound, just falls. Make it give me, Dayton pounds his chest. An Iraq attack, Iraq attack. Fork wants to know if we'd found anything on last night's raid. The usual, Dayton says, with that constant grin. Mostly screaming women. All right, this will be my last one here. Then if you have questions, or you can do that. This is called Intravenous. And there was a time, you know, if you have an infant, giving them an IV, sometimes, you know, you can't find a vein, so you'd go through the forehead. So this is about our medic, Doc Johnson, doing that once. And then the poem kind of goes elsewhere, but that's what it's based on, kind of him giving you know, in the middle of all this, like a very chaotic time, he just kind of has to put an IV into an infant girl's forehead. So, intravenous. The smoke's like a black rope rising from the village. How many days did I sit in the barracks at Bragg, staring at maps of this place as if it saved me? On this street, I couldn't say, in the roar of police sirens and mosque noises, which way's east, west, which way's the river. Doc's on his knees, next to the white opal's open door. The girl, months old, screams, the glass spread around her like rock salt on the blue seat cushions. Her blue leggings wet, stuck to the skin with her own blood. Light, Doc says, light. I lift the M4. Doc scissors her cotton sleeve, pushes his thumb to her arm for a vein. There's nothing. He brushes back the dozen or so black hair strands and finds it, eye to hairline, pulsing. See, he says, see? His fat hand grips her head hard to flex that vessel. On that smooth forehead, the vein runs in a curve that's like, for a moment, the tigress I've seen on maps. It's not, I know. I keep my rifle pointed through the shattered window as cars filled with wounded weave around us in the dust. Hold still, Doc says. Then he lowers, slowest thing I've ever seen, the needle to that blue-green vein, and I keep the M4's mounted light aimed, a small yellow ray beaming from below the barrel, steady toward her head in Doc's hand to help him see. Thank you very much for listening. I appreciate it. If you gotta go, go. But you know, so, or I'll be around to answer questions. So.
Any questions?